Morning Edition's Cokie Roberts recently had a story about why the United States has only two major political parties. It's a good question, especially as the country and Minnesota has realigned over time. And it's a question we wanted to pose to our Dig Deep guys. That's what I'm calling you now. Dig Deep guys.
Dig deep
gosh, I don't
know. Oh, we dig real deep there.
DD guys? DD guys.
Uh-huh. I think that's a different thing. I don't know if you want
okay.
to do that.
Okay, oh, I'm sorry.
No, Dungeons and Dragons, it's okay.
Oh, I see. Yeah, I'm not in that world. Yeah. I'm Heidi Olten, and joining me in the studio are Aaron Brown, our liberal commentator. Chuck Maroney's our conservative commentator. Thank you for being here.
Good to be here. Yeah.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
You're welcome. So let's begin this topic as we do, looking at the history of political parties, both nationally and in Minnesota.
Yeah. Well, I think we start with the idea that, hey, oh boy, partisanship, right? Everyone's upset about it. More people are too partisan. And there's all these current events and issues related to that. Let's go back to the very beginning, though, and looking at history, the idea that, say, George Washington, our first president, you know, I was a political nerd. I loved reading history and politics. And you go through the encyclopedias, the encyclopedia that my parents bought from the traveling salesman, probably the very last people in America to do that. I would always look, oh, so-and-so was a Republican or a Democrat, and go back farther and farther in history, and you get to George Washington, president numero uno, and he was not politically affiliated with a party. And in fact, he was one of many of the founding fathers, so to speak, that believed it would be better if America, the United States, avoided formal organized parties, that it would be better to let our elected representatives in our Republican system of government deal with the issues of the day independent of these factions. That was a very strong belief, a prevailing belief early in the Republic.
And this is because everybody generally got along back then, too. I mean, after the Revolution, pretty much.
You had a common enemy that was pretty clear. Everybody.
I was joking. I mean, this is some of like the most brutal fighting in American history.
Right.
Really.
Anytime you're starting, it's like starting a new thing, and then invariably after a little while, people within the thing decide to go different directions or form different conclusions about what to do or what system to use. And I think that it wasn't that there was total harmony among the framers of the Constitution. There certainly was lots of arguments about, particularly and especially about slavery. It took a long time to deal with that problem. But it wasn't a partisan issue. There was no Republicans or Democrats, you know. And so it's important to remember that this country did operate at a time, for a time, without political parties at all, not two parties, but there were no parties. But pretty quickly, as the Republic started to grow and expand, you started to see different factions form. Now, you always had rivalries within points of view in the government, and I think the earliest was the idea that the Federalists, the people associated with a strong federal government, who were primarily in that time, let's just say like John Adams, a New Englander, where they were looking at a strong federal government. And then you had this repeated through history, the southern states and more rural states, especially states where slavery was prevalent, the idea that there was a more state-oriented, states would be more independent of each other, and the federal government was well, frankly, more of a confederacy. Literally, there was the Articles of Confederation that were the early form of government in this country that failed for various reasons. But basically, the idea of it being a looser bond between the states, that they were aligned for strategic reasons, for self-defense and for some trade issues and things like that. But for the most part, there was a faction that saw individual states as being able to set their own laws and set their own currency even for a time. That did eventually go away. But so you have this idea of like the folks who favored a strong federal, active federal government and those who favored a less active, less affiliated federal government. And really that, I think, led to what would be the first political party. Goes by different names, but ironically, I always know it as the Democratic Republican Party. In other words, it was the party of, well, eventually viewed as the founder of the Democratic Party, Andrew Jackson. And I think who was the founder of the Democratic Republican Party before that? It was Jeffersonian in nature.
Yeah, it was descended from Jeffersonian ideals.
Jeffersonian ideas led to it. And this was the faction that was more in the category of states' rights states are independent, less dependent on a federal centralized government, more of an individual kind of thing.
But I think interpreting the Constitution to say very strictly, like if it's not a power expressly given to the federal government, it's reserved for the states.
Right.
And so we would limit what the federal government could do, and everything else would be, you know, from the people, the sovereign, the people.
Right. And for a while there, as the Federalists lost power, being overwhelmed as they were by the population of the country, you can kind of look at the quote-unquote elite, the moneyed elite, favored a strong federal system. Because for a lot of reasons, it was easier to have a strong federal government, especially on issues like trade and on currency issues. You know, those were big issues for the Federalists. Not so big for the guy tilling fields in Virginia or tilling fields in eastern Pennsylvania. It wasn't a populist issue, so the Federalists weren't a very popular party, except in really New England was their base of support.
Well, can I want to provide some context too, because I do think, you know, coming out of the Revolutionary War, you did have this general consensus that we're going to break free from England, no more king. And it's bizarre to us to think today, and I was at the nation's capital this summer, got a tour of the Capitol building. There's actually a place in the base, they call it the crypt, in like the lower level of the Capitol, where they were going to bury George Washington when they built it. Like, mm-hmm. They're like, here, George, this is where we're going to put you when you die, because mm-hmm. you're our American royalty. And, you know, he said no, like, I won't do it. His family said no after he died. It's hard for us to believe that there was a group that honestly thought that we should have a king, that king should be a guy named George Washington, and then there should be successive kings after that. And we won't do it by heredity the way they do in England, but we do it by aristocracy, you know, by some popular vote. We would name the leading gentleman to be the king, you know, whatever that was. So you have this period of time where we're really debating what it meant to have a country from the people, you know, as opposed to this monarchy. And you had the industrialists and you had the agrarians kind of going at it. But at the same time, you had this backdrop of the French Revolution, which was an echo of our revolution, much more violent, much more bloody, much more chaotic. And I think that did, for a period of time, stunt our, if we want to call them reforms or more liberalization, more embrace of democracy. Because the people who were there at the founding of the country really feared mob rule. You can see this in the way our Constitution is written, the checks and balances. You can see this in the Electoral College system. Mm-hmm. They feared mob rule. And for a while, they were able to kind of pacify that, like, hey, we can have a little bit of this. We're Americans. And you had Jefferson talking about, we'll have an educated populace and, you mm-hmm. know, they'll be...
But to an extent, because they were still aristocrats for the most part.
Exactly.
And were preserving the vestiges of their society as they understood it. And they understood or believed that people like them are the ones who should be running the country, not the collective opinions of all the people out tilling the fields.
Then you look across the ocean and you see the guillotine, like literally cutting off thousands of people's heads in mass fashion. You see the people rise up and storm the Bastille, and the French Revolution was crazy. I mean, it was insane, mm-hmm. and it freaked the heck out of these people. And there was a reaction over here to say, like, we will not let that happen to us. We are not going to go that route. Let's keep this, in a sense, like, organized and tight, and we'll have these factions, but it's not going to be like the people running things.
Mm-hmm. And really, the very name of our head of state is, I've read about how the term president came to be the name of our head of state. It was designed to be the most embarrassing, humiliating, low-level title you could give a person. They aren't the king. They aren't even the prime minister. They're the person who presides over the government. A president is like is almost an insult to a person who is running a country.
It's almost a passive term.
Right. There. And that was the point. Now, we today think of president, and other countries now call their leaders presidents. And because the power of America made the title seem to us in our modern light very important. Wow, president of the United States. But that was part of this early part of American democracy, where they wanted to acknowledge that we're not going to have mob rule, but we're also not going to have a king. And so the compromise was terms like president and vice president, which is, you know, the idea that these were people who they wanted to keep from being leaders of a mob, and that they were checked very much by the Congress and the Supreme Court, especially Congress. And I think we'll get into this, but that's one of the biggest things that has changed, I think, since the early American democracy, is how the power of the presidency has changed, and its and attitudes toward that has really affected the alignment of our political system.
You're listening to Dig Deep on Northern Community Radio. That's our liberal commentator, Aaron Brown. Our topic is about political parties, the history moving into the future. Chuck Marone, our conservative commentator, continues the conversation.
Well, and you see this, you know, in the early presidents, you see this tension because it's very difficult to run a country the way that it was initially set up. I tend to be, and when we talk about the today's Supreme Court, sympathetic to the originalists who kind of get like a bad rap.
Constructionists,
the strict
right?
constructionists, yeah. But if you do take a very strict constructionalist look at things, like the Louisiana Purchase doesn't happen.
Right.
All these things that it's fascinating to look at Jefferson, who was a strict constructionalist and a very not in favor of a strong central government. He becomes president and he orchestrates the Louisiana Purchase.
He doubles its size. Yeah.
Right. Doubles the size. He deploys people to take on the Barbary pirates. He pays off these Libyans essentially to not go after U.S. shipping. There's all these things that he did that were not really powers of the federal government, that this now created kind of factional system that I think brought us to Andrew Jackson.
Right.
Where you had the first real kind of seismic upheaval in a sense.
Right. And so the Democratic Party has an annual dinner every year that's a big kind of a Founders Day dinner for their party. And they call it the Jefferson Jackson dinner. And now that literally is the origin of their party, the Jeffersonian ideas that led to the Democratic Republican coalition. And then Andrew Jackson becomes, I think, the first big populist president, in that he had run for office on kind of a ticket of the what I guess you'd call the common man, in that's in the standards of the early 1800s, where that meant white guys who owned land for the most part, but not the aristocracy, not the wealthiest people, but rather the, I guess you'd call them the upper middle class or whatever of their time. But more of the common man was certainly what he was known for. You have to remember, he ran for president and won the popular vote. He's one of the presidents who won the popular vote but was not put into office because of the Electoral College. And it was John Quincy Adams, the son of son of John Adams, who served one term. But the first, he got in on basically the nuances of the Electoral College system. He ended up going to Congress, and he ended up winning to be president, holding out of office Andrew Jackson, who was this populist leader who, and people were outraged. That was one of the moments in American history where people were just outraged at each other and couldn't believe that this was going on. And it was happening quite a long time ago. But John Quincy Adams served his term, and he was like the last of the great Federalists, I guess you'd say.
Right.
And he was also the first president to appear in a photograph.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. There's a photo of him as a very old man after his presidency.
Okay.
But the first living person who had been a president. Anyway, so just give you some context here. But Andrew Jackson comes back the next time and I won't say he cleans his clock, but basically Andrew Jackson gets swept in the second time he runs and becomes president and a populist, that is to say a person who really appealed to the voters in larger numbers rather than the old notions of, you know, we don't have parties. And he formed, I guess, what you'd call, I won't call it the modern Democratic Party, but the corpus, the large idea of the Democratic Party started with that notion of populism.
I think it is the Democratic Party, though, that persisted until at least Woodrow Wilson, you could argue.
Oh, yeah. Through the 1800s, that's the Democratic Party. Right. It's the party of the South, of the slave-owning South. It's the party of the large urban centers like New York City, the poor parts of New York City. It becomes the party of the Irish and German immigrant.
I think historically you could almost say like the party of the people,
or
I think they would say at the time, the party of the rabble.
Right. They would say the rabble. Now keep in mind, and I think it's important. I think it's important to point out that women couldn't vote. African Americans couldn't vote. Large swaths of people couldn't vote and weren't a part of this. And in fact, the Democratic Party of that time was not very kind to those people. But it is identified as the party of the common person, and it grows. And at first, in the Jacksonian, the popularity of Andrew Jackson, a lot of people compare Andrew Jackson to Donald Trump today. There are those comparisons. I don't think they're entirely there, but there is certainly that element that the kind of connection there. And Donald Trump seems to be looking back at, and he hung a picture of Andrew Jackson up in the Oval Office. So the idea being that he kind of identifies with the Jacksonian model of leadership. So he's a very popular guy. And the funny thing when Andrew Jackson comes into power is that his opposition is really battered and divided. There isn't a Republican Party at that time yet.
Whigs.
The Whigs were a loose, I mean, the Whigs were a party, but they were a loosely affiliated party.
It's, and as Jackson's called, are they the Democrats?
They're
the
Democrats. The Democrats. Okay. They shorten it up to just the Democratic Party. And then you have the Whigs. And the Whigs are, I guess you'd say they're the anti-Democrats, but they aren't really unified.
I think the Whigs kind of like floundered in the desert for a long time. Yeah. It was like, we're the aristocracy. We're the essentially the descendants of the John Adams, the John Quincy Adams, the privileged class. But this democracy thing's kind of getting away from us.
Yeah.
It wasn't until Lincoln, when Lincoln kind of stepped up at this new Republican Party and found a voice with the people, but a different group of the people, so that you had, you know, basically like the modern two-party system be established along the lines that it is today.
So we had this original sin in this country of slavery. It's this big thing that shaped both how the Constitution came together, and then really the politics of the next 100 years is trying to keep the country together without offending either side too much on the slavery issue. It's really what the Missouri Compromise and things like this that are happening later.
Trying to find a balance where everybody in power's interests were protected. Because you had the Northern industrialists and the Southern, you know, plantation owners that held power. And how do you find a way to keep everybody trading and everybody happy? Well, you ignore slavery and you let the aristocracy of the North stay in power. And so that was a big part of the non-party to party evolution process.
So the Whigs come together and are really the anti-Democrats, not really well organized. They do win a couple of presidential elections. I don't believe they ever held a majority in Congress.
I don't think they ever held
Congress. No. They never held Congress. And
who are the Whig presidents?
Polk.
Yeah, Polk was a big one. He was the expansionist. Other than Jefferson with the Louisiana Purchase, Polk gets us into California all the way to the Pacific Ocean.
Not any that you're going to like see on the next Mount Rushmore. This was like...
Polk serves one term. I think of one-term presidents, I want to put Polk out there as the guy who did the most in 4 years. Okay.
But this was a period of time when Congress held all the power. Mm-hmm. And the president was like the presider.
Right.
And really, I mean, the issue of slavery and all the things that were kind of catalyzed around it really paralyzed everything.
Mm-hmm. And the Whig Party, too, was paralyzed by it because there were pro-slavery factions in the Whig coalition. The Whigs kind of fell apart because of the slavery issue. It's a little like when you see, and we'll get to this in future, but when you talk about a party that has an internal divide and it ends up affecting that party's electoral success because the people in the party can't agree. That's what slavery was in the Whig Party. And it ended up basically, you know, maybe 10, 12 years before the Civil War, the Whig Party's falling apart. There's nothing there to it. And the Democrats are sailing. The Democrats do have some abolitionist elements, but mostly is the party that's going to protect the institution of slavery. And then as the Free Soil Party is actually, I think, the name of the early movement, the Free Soil Movement. Free Soil meaning free new states should not have slavery. And that was the movement that really started to galvanize a new party. And the Free Soil Movement, what was that guy's name? From California, he was a general, Farrat.
Oh, that one doesn't ring a bell.
Anyway, he was the guy who runs, I think, maybe I've conflated his name with Fremont. Okay, Farrat is a former Vikings backup quarterback. Fremont is the guy I was searching
for. We do a radio show.
No, because you got to understand how I went through the Rolodex and it was there. So Fremont is the guy who runs as the first Republican. The Republican Party forms in the as this Free Soil movement is forming. The Republican Party picks up the piece, the abolitionist portions, the northeastern portions of the Whig Party. But it's also more than that. And this is actually the political education and growth of Abraham Lincoln is happening at this time. So we aren't to Lincoln yet, but Lincoln is a guy, he runs for Congress in his one term that he runs on the notion of being infrastructure guy. You know, he's improvements, internal improvements, they call it. The idea that you're building these communities, these Western communities are growing and we need to expand the communities. He'd be the guy saying that rural areas in the West, these new towns need railroad service. They need all these services. And so this is the what becomes the Free Soil Republican movement is the opposition to slavery, not always because they're racially sensitive, but rather because they support the notion that people should work for their money and should be paid for their work, vice versa, and that slavery is unfair to the people who work for a living, essentially. It is the really catalyst of the early Republican Party. And so Fremont doesn't win for president, but a rising, a two-time failed Senate candidate who served one term in Congress, a guy named Abraham Lincoln is the most popular, well-known guy. And despite there being a number of really qualified candidates in 1860, we see Abraham Lincoln nominated as the Republican nominee for president. He becomes the first Republican president. And it really brings us to a key point in the...
Now you have two political parties.
Now you have two strong political parties.
Okay, we're going to start with Lincoln when we begin our next Dig Deep segment having to do with political parties on Northern Community Radio. It's Aaron Brown and Chuck Marone.